As Jesus came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. As for yourselves, beware. For they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues. And you will stand before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. When they bring you to trial and hand you over, do not worry beforehand what you are to say, but say whatever is given to you at that time, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and father his child. And children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved." This is the word of the Lord. Of all the tough things that Jesus ever said to his disciples, that had to be the worst. That the temple of Jerusalem would be tossed down. Those upcountry fishermen probably didn't get to Jerusalem maybe more than once a year. It was a straight 35-hour walk each way, probably done over 3 or 4 days. There were certainly no buildings that large back in Capernaum, probably nothing over one story tall. And the main section of the temple was over 100 feet high. Who would ever think of that coming down? The Jews of that day meant it literally when they said the temple was God's house. God rules from the heavens, but the temple was where God touched down on earth. The scriptures spoke of it as the Lord's footstool. So what did it mean to declare that not one stone would be left standing on another? Did that mean that God had left the building? Or worse, that God was powerless to stop the destruction? I'm sure the disciples were shaken by what Jesus said. It was hard for them to imagine that the central shrine of Jewish faith would be torn down and destroyed, even though that had happened about 600 years before. In 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar began a siege on the city of Jerusalem that lasted over a year. His Babylonian army smashed through the city walls, captured all the city leaders, made them slaves, and then pulled down the great temple of Solomon. This was the crisis that inspired about a third of the Old Testament, the third that they never got around to teaching me in Sunday school. The prophets were trying to interpret how this could happen to God's house, among God's people. The building comes down. Does that mean that God is punishing them for doing something wrong? Or that God decided to let this happen for some mysterious reason? Or was God unable to stop it from happening? Or is this simply the shape of what it's like to love and worship God in a world like this? All good questions without any conclusive answers, and a good share of the scriptures try to make sense out of this terrible disruption. And now Jesus says it'll be torn down again. It's hard to imagine that too. This was the second temple, a long-term rebuilding project that had been going on for about 500 years. There have been a lot of stops, a couple of invasions, a couple of starts. And in the day of Jesus, it was still the sanctuary where God was worshipped, the only altar where the sacrifices of Israel were made. It's the center of the entire nation's faith and hope. And within 40 years of Jesus' words, again, the walls came tumbling down, this time at the hand of the Roman Empire. To this day, all that remains is a section of one wall, now called the Wailing Wall. The pilgrims go there to pray. The security is tight. They pass through the metal detectors, past the bomb-sniffing dogs. Then they wash their hands in purity, cover their heads, and write down on slips of paper the prayers that they wish to leave in the cracks of the wall. When I was there 18 years ago, I wrote down the names of my kids. Still there, unless one of the rabbis has cleaned it out. So the question for us is, what do you do when the central place in your life is no more? Maybe that's a question you've had to face. Someone was telling me about returning to the town of her childhood. She hadn't been there for years. She was in a rental car. She saw the familiar street sign. She took a left. She went down the next stop sign, proceeded into the next block. She slowed down as she came around the bend, leaned forward to look, and there was nothing there. The old house, gone. The maple tree out front had met a chainsaw. Everything she remembered, everything she told herself she remembered, had disappeared. It was profoundly disturbing, she said. And when I tried to recall how it looked, that was gone too. Do you know how she feels? Progress is progress, I suppose, but progress is way overrated. A couple of years ago, I drove down Emmons Drive, the New Jersey street where my seminary apartment was located. 312 Emmons Drive, that was where the GPS took me, leveled to the ground. Now, that wasn't a big loss because the place was a dump. The heating system was always goofed up. Our cat had gotten infested with fleas. Good to see the place go. But don't say that to the elderly couple who no longer go to church. Once upon a time, they went every week. They met in the Sunday school, fell in love in the youth group, walked down the aisle to get married, presented three children for baptism. Then the neighborhood changed. The people they knew moved away or passed on. And there weren't enough hands in that church to keep the lights on, so the whole church shut down. They tried to connect with other churches, it just wasn't the same. The couple stopped going anywhere. What do you do when the sanctuary no longer exists? Jesus is offering an ominous warning. Perhaps it's true that no building is permanent, that no institution is secure, that no configuration of familiar people is everlasting. And I'm not sure I want to hear that, even if it's true. I mean, I love you people. I love this building. I can't imagine if this were all ever to go away, or if our faith community would have to be shut down someday. I suppose that's one of the hard realities of being human, of being mortal. Everything we love has an expiration date. After 58 trips around the sun, I know that all too well. So I begin to think maybe abundant life is claiming the opportunities we have here and now, savoring the moment, enjoying what we have while we have it. It's kind of like the book of Ecclesiastes, which is kind of a grumpy old book. Ecclesiastes is a wisdom manual written by somebody in the middle of a midlife crisis. I tried chasing after pleasure, says the writer. I tried making a lot of money. I tried working hard. I tried flying straight. I tried just about everything. It was like reaching for a puff of smoke. So, says the sage, this is all I got. Eat, drink, be merry, find enjoyment in your toil, follow the commandments, and above all, fear God. In other words, love God and keep your head down. And that is a time-honored way of getting through a lot of things. But I have to say, the wisdom of Jesus is more intentional. In the text today, he basically says three things. Discern what's going on, stay patient, keep preaching. Let me say a few words about each. First, to quote Marvin Gaye, what's going on? If we trace the long history of temples being torn down, we discover all over again that we are in the thick of an endless skirmish between good and evil. And it's not merely the people out there who oppose us that we have to worry about. It's also what we are all capable of doing to ourselves. The threats are both external and internal. The Roman Empire was the greatest and most luxurious of its time, yet it built its affluence on the backs of brutality, and it would eventually implode from moral rot. We can learn a lot of lessons from that. Similarly, I know a lot of congregations that grew big in the 1950s after returning soldiers had a lot of babies. The churches grew. They were tempted then to indulge themselves rather than give themselves. And as the affluence of the society grew, the churches plateaued, lost a little steam. When the cities wrestled with racial tension, the churches and their people moved out to the suburbs. Says, not my backyard. And when everybody in the culture became nominally Christian, there were a lot of nominal Christians and precious few followers of Jesus. When the communities changed, the churches weren't nimble enough or self-sacrificing enough to change with them. As a buddy of mine who worked as an overseer of many churches once said, we've got a lot of great church buildings in the wrong town. And so, what's going on? Jesus said, don't be led astray. Don't be led astray in our day by a false sense of comfort. We must read what is really happening, and that's discernment. But second, add to that some patience, what my friend Ched Myers calls revolutionary patience. Ched says that, especially in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is telling us to hang in and plan for the long haul. Don't chase after the latest fad. Don't worry about the crisis du jour. Dig in and stay faithful to God. If the world beats you up, if the world puts you on trial, this is to be expected because it happened to Christ first. We are part of that grand narrative of good versus evil. It's been going on for a long time, and by all accounts, it will probably continue. Maybe you heard people ask the rabbi at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, what are you going to do after a gunman has invaded your sanctuary? He said, we will keep worshiping the holy God and keeping God's commandments. He said, we're on a 3,000-year business plan around here. What happened was a terrible thing, but faithfulness to God is expressed in perseverance. We keep going. We know the world will do what it's going to do, but we're going to do what God calls us to do. That's the revolutionary patience. It's more than just being patient, it's staying patient, taking the long perspective, persisting in an eternal view. And finally, he says, keep preaching. He's not telling the preachers that, he's telling the church that. If the roof falls in, keep preaching, or more specifically, keep proclaiming. Caruso's the word, proclaim. It means speaking, but more than speaking. It is courageously proclaiming that our message is more important than we are. The gospel is God's announcement that sin is canceled by grace, that hatred is washed pure by love, that death is defeated by resurrection. It's the word that grace, love, and resurrection will finally win. And we simply have to trust that, live that. One of my favorite scenes of this is from a Friedrich Buechner novel where a lot of terrible things happen. Main character is a Protestant minister named Nicolette. He lost his wife in a car accident. He's raising two small girls with the help of a Jewish housekeeper. In a turn of events, past part of his work, he travels out of town to go get a wayward church member and bring her home to her husband. But the local newspaper editor has had not a lot of things to write about, so he makes more of that story than actually happened. None of it's true, but damage is done. So Nicolette brings the lady back to reunite with her husband, and then a teenage prank in town goes awry. His housekeeper dies after her house catches fire. So at the end of the book, the whole town is gathered around her grave, and Nicolette reads the familiar words from the end of the Bible. God shall wipe away all tears. There shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor sighing, nor shall there be any more pain. The former things have passed away. He speaks for a few minutes, gives the benediction. The people shuffle away with their umbrellas, and one turns back. It's Poteet, the sleazy newspaper editor who caused all the turmoil when Nicolette was out of town. Good show, he says to the preacher cynically. He points to the grave and sneers, this supper of the great God, no more death, no more pain. Yeah, right, ask her. The preacher stands silent, two daughters by his side, doesn't know what to say, but then his daughters do an unexpected thing. Listen. They grabbed up some of the flowers they had brought and they started pelting the newspaper editor with them. Orange hawkweed, daisies, clover, and stooping over like a great pale bear in his baggy seersucker suit, he then turned and lunged at them with his finger. Nicolette threw back his head and laughed as Poteet goes lumbering off, the two girls chasing him, still pelting him with flowers. And when he got as far as the car, he turned around for a minute, and then the preacher could see he was more or less laughing. What do you do when the roof falls in? You proclaim the kingdom of God. Even if life should turn deadly, we proclaim the power of God that is stronger than death. And preach and proclaim we shall. Until the day when there are no more tears, when death has no more power, and when all our grief is swallowed up in laughter.